in the building where he taught his Monday, Wednesday, Friday classes, and everything had been cancelled.
"Lucy told me about that," Conchetta said. "And of course, I already knew about the 9/11 crying jag and the phantom piano. I took a run up there a week or two later. I told Lucy not to say a word to Abra about my visit, but Abra knew. She planted herself in front of the door 10 minutes before I showed up. When Lucy asked who was coming, Abra said, 'Momo.'"
"She does that a lot," David said. "Not every time someone's coming, but if it's someone she knows and likes, almost always."
In the late spring of 2003, Lucy found her daughter in their bedroom, tugging at the second drawer of Lucy's dresser. "Mun," she told her mother. "Mun! Mun!"
"I don't get you, sweetie," Lucy said. "But you can look in the drawer if you want to. It's just some old underwear and leftover cosmetics."
But Abra had no interest in the drawer, it seemed. Didn't even look in it when Lucy pulled it out to show her what was inside.
"Hind! Mun!"
Then drawing a deep breath.
"Mun! Hind! Mama!"
Parents never become absolutely fluent in baby. There's not enough time. But most learn to speak it to some degree, and Lucy finally understood that her daughter's interest wasn't in the contents of the dresser, but in something behind it. Curious, she pulled it out. Abra darted into the space immediately. Lucy, thinking that it would be dusty in there even if there weren't bugs or mice, made a swipe for the back of the baby's shirt and missed. By the time she got the dresser out far enough to slip into the gap herself, Abra was holding up a $20 bill that had found its way through the hole between the dresser's surface and the bottom of the mirror.
"Look," she said gleefully. "Mun! My mun!"
"Nope," Lucy said, plucking it out of the small fist. "Babies don't get mun because they don't need mun. But you did just earn yourself an ice cream cone."
"Ikeem!" Abra shouted. "My Ikeem!"
"Now tell Dr. John about Mrs. Judkins," David said. "You were there for that."
"Indeed I was," Conchetta said. "That was some 4th of July weekend." By the summer of 2003, Abra had begun speaking in, more or less, full sentences. Conchetta had come to spend the holiday weekend with the Stones. On the Sunday, which happened to be July 6th, Dave had gone to the 7-Eleven to buy a fresh canister of Blue Rhino for the backyard barbecue. Abra was playing with blocks in the living room. Lucy and Chetta were in the kitchen, one of them checking periodically on Abra to make sure she hadn't decided to pull out the plug on the TV and chew it or go climbing Mount Sofa. But Abra showed no interest in those things. She was busy constructing what looked like a stone hinge made out of her plastic toddler blocks. Lucy and Chetta were unloading the dishwasher when Abra began to scream.
"She sounded like she was dying," Chetta said. "You know how scary that is, right?"
John nodded. He knew.
"Running doesn't come naturally to me at my age, but I ran like Wilma Rudolph that day. Beat Lucy to the living room by half a length. I was so convinced the kid was hurt that for a second or two I actually saw blood. But she was okay. Physically, anyhow. She ran to me and threw her arms around my legs. I picked her up. Lucy was with me by then, and we managed to get her soothed a little.
'Wani,' she said. 'Help Wani, Momo. Wani, fall down.'
I didn't know who Wani was, but Lucy did. Wanda Judkins, the lady across the street."
"She's Abra's favorite neighbor," David said, "because she makes cookies and usually brings one over for Abra with her name written on it, sometimes in raisins, sometimes in frosting. She's a widow, lives alone." "So we went across," Chetta resumed. "Me in the lead and Lucy holding Abra. I knocked. No one answered."
"Wani in the dinner room,"
Abra said.
"Help Wani, Momo. Help Wani, Mama. She hurted herself and blood is coming out."
The door was unlocked. We went in. First thing I smelled was burning cookies. Mrs. Judkins was lying on the dining room floor next to a stepladder. The rag she'd been using to dust out the moldings was still in her hand. But there was blood, all right. A puddle of it around her head, in a kind of halo. I thought she was finished. I couldn't see her breathing. But Lucy found a pulse. The fall fractured her skull, and there was a small brain bleed, but she woke up the next day. She'll be at Abra's birthday party. You can say hello to her if you come. She looked at Abra Stone's pediatrician unflinchingly. The doctor at the ER said that if she'd lain there much longer, she would have either died or ended up in a persistent vegetative state. Far worse than death, in my humble opinion. Either way, the kid saved her life. John tossed his pen on top of the legal pad. I don't know what to say. There's more, Dave said, but the other stuff's hard to quantify. Maybe just because Lucy and I have gotten used to it. The way I guess you'd get used to living with a kid who was born blind. Except this is almost the opposite of that. I think we knew even before the 9/11 thing. I think we knew there was something, almost from the time we brought her home from the hospital. It's like... He huffed out a breath and looked at the ceiling as if for inspiration. Conchetta squeezed his arm. Go on. At least he hasn't called for the men with the butterfly nets yet. Okay. It's like there's always a wind blowing through the house, only you can't exactly feel it or see what it's doing. I keep thinking the curtains are going to billow and the pictures are going to fly off the walls, but they never do. Other stuff does happen, though. Two or three times a week, sometimes two or three times a day, the circuit breakers trip. We've had two different electricians out on four different occasions. They check the circuits and tell us everything is hunky-dory. Some mornings we come downstairs and the cushions from the chairs and the sofa are on the floor. We tell Abra to put her toys away before bed, and unless she's overtired and cranky, she's very good about it. But sometimes the toy box will be open the next morning and some of the toys will be back on the floor. Usually the blocks. They're her favorites. He paused for a moment, now looking at the eye chart on the far wall. John thought Conchetta would prod him to go on, but she kept silent. Okay. This is totally weird, but I swear to you it happened. One night, when we turned on the TV, The Simpsons were on every channel. Abra laughed like it was the biggest joke in the world. Lucy freaked out. She said, Abra Raffaella Stone, if you're doing that, stop it right now. Lucy hardly ever speaks sharply to her, and when she does, Abra just dissolves, which is what happened that night. I turned off the TV, and when I turned it on again, everything was back to normal. I could give you a half a dozen other things, incidents, phenomena, but most of it so small you'd hardly even notice. He shrugged. Like I say, you get used to it. John said, I'll come to the party. After all that, how can I resist? Probably nothing will happen, Dave said. You know the old joke about how to stop a leaky faucet, don't you? Call the plumber. Conchetta snorted. If you really believe that, sonny boy, I think you might get a surprise. And to Dalton, just getting him here was like pulling teeth. Give it a rest, Momo. Color had begun to rise in Dave's cheeks. John sighed. He had sensed the antagonism between these two before. He didn't know the cause of it, some kind of competition for Lucy, perhaps, but he didn't want it breaking out into the open now. Their bizarre errand had turned them into temporary allies, and that was the way he wanted to keep it. Save the sniping. He spoke sharply enough so they looked away from each other and back at him, surprised. I believe you. I've never heard of anything remotely like this before. Or had he? He trailed off, thinking of his lost watch. Doc, David said. Sorry, brain cramp. At this they both smiled. Allies again. Good. Anyway, no one's going to send for the men in the white coats. I accept you both as level-headed folks, not prone to hysteria or hallucination. I might guess some bizarre form of Munchausen syndrome was at work if it was just one person claiming these psychic outbreaks. But it's not. It's all three of you. Which raises the question, what do you want me to do?
Dave seemed at a loss, but his grandmother-in-law was not.
Observe her, the way you would any child with a disease.
The color had begun to leave David Stone's cheeks, but now it rushed back, slammed back. Abra is not sick, he snapped.
She turned to him. I know that. Christo, will you let me finish?
Dave put on a long, suffering expression and raised his hands. Sorry, sorry, sorry.
Just don't jump down my throat, David.
John said,
If you insist on bickering, children, I'll have to send you to the quiet room.
Conchetta sighed.
This is very stressful. For all of us.
I'm sorry, Davy. I used the wrong word.
No prob, Cara. We're in this together.
She smiled briefly.
Yes. Yes, we are. Observe her as you'd observe any child with an undiagnosed condition, Dr. Dalton. That's all we can ask, and I think it's enough for now. You may have some ideas. I hope so. You see.
She turned to David Stone with an expression of helplessness that John thought was probably rare on that firm face.
We're afraid, Dave said. Me, Lucy, Chetta. Scared to death. Not of her, but for her. Because she's just little. Do you see? What if this power of hers, I don't know what else to call it. What if it hasn't topped out yet? What if it's still growing? What do we do then? She could... I don't know.
He does know, Chetta said. She could lose her temper and hurt herself or someone else. I don't know how likely that is, but just thinking it could happen.
She touched John's hand. It's awful.
7. Dan Torrance knew he would be living in the turret room of the Helen Rivington house from the moment he had seen his old friend Tony waving to him from a window that on second look turned out to be boarded shut. He asked Mrs. Clausen, the Rivingtons' chief supervisor, about the room 6 months or so after going to work at the hospice as janitor orderly and unofficial doctor in residence, along with his faithful sidekick, Azzy, of course.
That room's junk from one end to the other, Mrs. Clausen had said. She was a 60-something with implausibly red hair. She was possessed of a sarcastic, often dirty mouth, but she was a smart and compassionate administrator. Even better, from the standpoint of HRH's board of directors, she was a tremendously effective fundraiser. Dan wasn't sure he liked her, but he had come to respect her.
I'll clean it out on my own time. It would be better for me to be right here, don't you think? On call?
Danny, tell me something. How come you're so good at what you do?
I don't really know. This was at least half true. Maybe even 70%. He had lived with The Shining all his life and still didn't understand it.
Junk aside, the turret's hot in the summer and cold enough to freeze the balls off a brass monkey in the winter.
That can be rectified, Dan had said.
Don't talk to me about your rectum.
Mrs. Clausen peered sternly at him from above her half-glasses.
If the board knew what I was letting you do, they'd probably have me weaving baskets in that assisted living home down in Nashua, the one with the pink walls and the piped-in Mantovani.
She snorted. Doctor sleep, indeed.
I'm not the doctor, Dan said mildly. He knew he was going to get what he wanted.
Azzy's the doctor. I'm just his assistant.
Azrael's a fucking cat, she said. A raggedy-ass stray that wandered in off the street and got adopted by guests who have now all gone to the great who knows. All he cares about is his twice-daily bowl of Friskies.
To this, Dan hadn't responded. There was no need, because they both knew it wasn't true.
I thought you had a perfectly good place on Elliott Street. Pauline Robertson thinks the sun shines out of your asshole. I know because I sing with her in the church choir. "What's your favorite hymn?" Dan asked. "What a fucking friend we have in Jesus."
She showed the Rebecca Clausen version of a smile.
"Oh, very well. Clean out the room. Move in. Have it wired for cable. Put in quadraphonic sound. Set up a wet bar. What the hell do I care? I'm only the boss."
"Thanks, Mrs. C."
"Oh, and don't forget the space heater, okay? See if you can't find something from a yard sale with a nice frayed cord. Burn the fucking place down some cold February night. Then they can put up a brick monstrosity to match the abortions on either side of us."
Dan stood up and raised the back of his hand to his forehead in a half-assed British salute.
"Whatever you say, boss."
She waved a hand at him.
"Get out of here before I change my mind, Doc."
8. He did put in a space heater, but the cord wasn't frayed, and it was the kind that shut off immediately if it tipped over. There was never going to be any air conditioning in the third-floor turret room, but a couple of fans from Walmart placed in the open windows provided a nice cross-draft. It got plenty hot just the same on summer days, but Dan was almost never there in the daytime. And summer nights in New Hampshire were usually cool. Most of the stuff that had been stashed up there was disposable junk, but he kept a big grammar school-style blackboard he found leaning against one wall. It had been hidden for 50 years or more behind an ironmongery of ancient and grievously wounded wheelchairs. The blackboard was useful. On it, he listed the hospice's patients and their room numbers, erasing the names of the folks who passed away and adding names as new folks checked in. In the spring of 2004, there were 32 names on the board. 10 were in Rivington 1 and 12 in Rivington 2. These were the ugly brick buildings flanking the Victorian home where the famous Helen Rivington had once lived and written thrilling romance novels under the pulsating name of Jeanette Montpals. The rest of the patients were housed on the 2 floors below Dan's cramped but serviceable turret apartment. "Was Mrs. Rivington famous for anything besides writing bad novels?" Dan had asked Claudette Albertson not long after starting work at the hospice. They were in the smoking area at the time, practicing their nasty habit. Claudette, a cheerful African-American RN with the shoulders of an NFL left tackle, threw back her head and laughed. "You bet. For leaving this town a shitload of money, honey. And giving away this house, of course. She thought old folks should have a place where they could die with dignity." And in Rivington House, most of them did. Dan, with Azzy to assist, was now a part of that. He thought he had found his calling. The hospice now felt like home. 9. On the morning of Abra's birthday party, Dan got out of bed and saw that all the names on his blackboard had been erased. Written where they had been, in large and straggling letters, was a single word. H-E-L-L-O. There was a smiley face inside of the O. Dan sat on the edge of the bed in his underwear for a long time, just looking. Then he got up and put one hand on the letters, smudging them a little, hoping for a shine, even a little twinkle. At last he took his hand away, rubbing chalk dust on his bare thigh. "Hello yourself," he said, and then, "Would your name be Abra, by any chance?" Nothing. He put on his robe, got his soap and towel, and went down to the staff shower on 2. When he came back, he picked up the eraser he'd found to go with the board and began erasing the word. Halfway through, a thought, "Daddy says we'll have balloons," came to him, and he stopped, waiting for more. But no more came, so he finished erasing the board and then began replacing the names and room numbers, working from that Monday's attendance memo. When he came back upstairs at noon, he half expected the board to be erased again, the names and numbers replaced by "hello," but all was as he had left it. 10. Abra's birthday party was in the Stones' backyard, a restful sweep of green grass with apple and dogwood trees that were just coming into blossom. At the foot of the yard was a chain-link fence and a gate secured by a combination padlock. The fence was decidedly unbeautiful, but neither David nor Lucy cared because beyond it was the Saco River, which wound its way southeast through Fraser, through North Conway and across the border into Maine. Rivers and small children did not mix, in the Stones' opinion, especially in the spring when this one was wide and turbulent with melting snows. Each year, the local weekly reported at least one drowning. Today, the kids had enough to occupy them on the lawn. The only organized game they could manage was a brief round of follow the leader, but they weren't too young to run around and sometimes roll around on the grass, to climb like monkeys on Abra's playset, to crawl through the fun tunnels David and a couple of the other dads had set up, and to bat around the balloons now drifting everywhere. These were all yellow, Abra's professed favorite color, and there were at least 6 dozen, as John Dalton could attest. He had helped Lucy and her grandmother blow them up. For a woman in her 80s, Chetta had an awesome set of lungs. There were 9 kids, counting Abra, and because at least one of every parental set had come, there was plenty of adult supervision. Lawn chairs had been set up on the back deck, and as the party hit cruising speed, John sat in one of these next to Conchetta, who was dolled up in designer jeans and her world's best great-grandma sweatshirt. She was working her way through a giant slice of birthday cake. John, who had taken on a few pounds of ballast during the winter, settled for a single scoop of strawberry ice cream. "I don't know where you put it," he said, nodding at the rapidly disappearing cake on her paper plate. "There's nothing to you. You're a stuffed string."
"Maybe so, Carl, but I've got a hollow leg."
She surveyed the roistering children and fetched a deep sigh.
"I wish my daughter could have lived to see this. I don't have many regrets, but that's one of them."
John decided not to venture out on this conversational limb. Lucy's mother had died in a car accident when Lucy was younger than Abra was now. This he knew from the family history the Stones had filled out jointly. In any case, Chetta turned the conversation herself.
"Do you know what I like about 'em at this age?"
"Nope." John liked them at all ages, at least until they turned 14. When they turned 14, their glands went into hyperdrive and most of them felt obliged to spend the next 5 years being booger snots.
"Look at them, Johnny. It's the kiddie version of that Edward Hicks painting, The Peaceable Kingdom. You've got 6 white ones.
Of course you do. It's New Hampshire.
But you've also got 2 black ones, and 1 gorgeous Korean-American baby who looks like she should be modeling clothes in the Hannah Anderson catalog. You know the Sunday school song that goes, 'Red and yellow, black and white, they are precious in his sight.' That's what we have here. 2 hours, and not one of them has raised a fist or given a push in anger."
John, who had seen plenty of toddlers who kicked, pushed, punched, and bit, gave a smile in which cynicism and wistfulness were exactly balanced.
"I wouldn't expect anything different. They all go to Little Chums. It's the smart set daycare in these parts, and they charge smart set prices. That means their parents are all at least upper middle. They're all college grads, and they all practice the gospel of go along to get along. These kids are your basic domesticated social animals."
John stopped there because she was frowning at him, but he could have gone farther. He could have said that until the age of 7 or thereabouts, the so-called age of reason, most children were emotional echo chambers. If they grew up around people who got along and didn't raise their voices, they did the same. If they were raised by biters and shouters, well... 20 years of treating little ones, not to mention raising 2 of his own now away at good go-along-to-get-along prep schools, hadn't destroyed all the romantic notions he'd held when first deciding to specialize in pediatric medicine, but those years had tempered them. Perhaps kids really did come into the world trailing clouds of glory, as Wordsworth had so confidently proclaimed, but they also shit in their pants until they learned better.
11.
A silvery run of bells, like those on an ice cream truck, sounded in the afternoon air. The kids turned to see what was up. Riding onto the lawn from the Stones' driveway was an amiable apparition, a young man on a wildly oversized red tricycle. He was wearing white gloves and a zoot suit with comically wide shoulders. In one lapel was a boutonniere the size of a hothouse orchid. His pants, also oversized, were currently hiked up to his knees as he worked the pedals. The handlebars were hung with bells, which he rang with one finger. The trike rocked from side to side, but never quite fell over. On the newcomer's head, beneath a huge brown derby, was a crazy blue wig. David Stone was walking behind him, carrying a large suitcase in one hand and a fold-up table in the other. He looked bemused.
"Hey, kids! Hey, kids!" the man on the trike shouted. "Gather round, gather round, because the show is about to start."
He didn't need to ask them twice. They were already flocking toward the trike, laughing and shouting. Lucy came over to John and Chetta, sat down and blew hair out of her eyes with a comical foof of her lower lip. She had a smudge of chocolate frosting on her chin.
"Behold the magician. He's a street performer in Fraser and North Conway during the summer season. Dave saw an ad in one of those freebie newspapers, auditioned the guy, and hired him. His name is Reggie Pelletier, but he styles himself the Great Mysterio. Let's see how long he can hold their attention once they've all had a good close look at the fancy trike. I'm thinking 3 minutes tops."
John thought she might be wrong about that. The guy's entrance had been perfectly calculated to capture the imaginations of little ones, and his wig was funny rather than scary. His cheerful face was unmarked by grease paint, and that was also good. Clowns, in John's opinion, were highly overrated. They scared the shit out of kids under 6. Kids over that age merely found them boring. My, you're in a bilious mood today. Maybe because he'd come ready to observe some sort of freaky-deaky and nothing had transpired. To him, Abra seemed like a perfectly ordinary little kid. Cheerier than most, maybe, but good cheer seemed to run in the family. Except when Chetta and Dave were sniping at each other, there was. "Don't underestimate the attention spans of the wee folk." He leaned past Chetta and used his napkin to wipe the smudge of frosting from Lucy's chin.
"If he has an act, he'll hold them for 15 minutes at least, maybe 20.
"If he does," Lucy said skeptically. It turned out that Reggie Pelletier, a.k.a. the Great Mysterio, did have an act and a good one. While his faithful assistant, the not-so-great Dave, set up his table and opened the suitcase, Mysterio asked the birthday girl and her guests to admire his flower. When they drew close, it shot water into their faces, first red, then green, then blue. They screamed with sugar-fueled laughter.
"Now, boys and girls! Ooh! Ah! Yike! That tickles!"
He took off his derby and pulled out a white rabbit. The kids gasped. Mysterio passed the bunny to Abra, who stroked it and then passed it on without having to be told. The rabbit didn't seem to mind the attention. Maybe, John thought, it had snarked up a few Valium-laced pellets before the show. The last kid handed it back to Mysterio, who popped it into his hat, passed a hand over it, and then showed them the inside of the derby. Except for the American flag lining, it was empty.
"Where did the bunny go?"
little Susie Song Bartlett asked.
"Into your dreams, darling," Mysterio said. "It'll hop there tonight. Now who wants a magic scarf?"
There were cries of, "I do, I do," from boys and girls alike. Mysterio produced them from his fists and passed them out. This was followed by more tricks in rapid-fire succession. By Dalton's watch, the kids stood around Mysterio in a bug-eyed semicircle for at least 25 minutes. And just as the first signs of restiveness began to appear in the audience, Mysterio wrapped things up. He produced 5 plates from his suitcase, which when he showed it had appeared to be as empty as his hat,
and juggled them, singing Happy Birthday to You as he did it. All the kids joined in, and Abra seemed almost to levitate with joy. The plates went back into the suitcase. He showed it to them again so they could see it was empty, then produced half a dozen spoons from it. These he proceeded to hang on his face, finishing with one on the tip of his nose. The birthday girl liked that one. She sat down on the grass, laughing and hugging herself with glee.
"Abba can do that," she said.
She was currently fond of referring to herself in the third person. It was what David called her Ricky Henderson phase.
"Abba can do spoons."
"Good for you, honey,"
Mysterio said. He wasn't really paying attention, and John couldn't blame him for that. He had just put on one hell of a kiddie matinee. His face was red and damp with sweat in spite of the cool breeze blowing up from the river, and he still had his big exit to make, this time pedaling the oversized trike uphill. He bent and patted Abra's head with one white-gloved hand.
"Happy birthday to you. And thank all you kids for being such a good odd."
From inside the house came a large and musical jangling, not unlike the sound of the bells hanging from the Godzilla trike's handlebars. The kids only glanced in that direction before turning to watch Mysterio pedal away, but Lucy got up to see what had fallen over in the kitchen.
2 minutes later, she came back outside. "John," she said, "you better look at this. I think it's what you came to see."
12. John, Lucy, and Conchetta stood in the kitchen, looking up at the ceiling and saying nothing. None of them turned when Dave joined them. They were hypnotized.
"What?" he began, then saw what.
"Holy shit."
To this, no one replied. David stared a little longer, trying to get the sense of what he was seeing, then left. A minute or two later, he returned, leading his daughter by the hand. Abra was holding a balloon. Around her waist, worn like a sash, was the scarf she'd received from the great Mysterio. John Dalton dropped to one knee beside her.
"Did you do that, honey?"
It was a question to which he felt sure he knew the answer, but he wanted to hear what she had to say. He wanted to know how much she was aware of.
Abra first looked at the floor where the silverware drawer lay. Some of the knives and forks had bounced free when the drawer shot from its socket, but they were all there. Not the spoons, however. The spoons were hanging from the ceiling, as if drawn upward and held by some exotic magnetic attraction. A couple swung lazily from the overhead light fixtures. The biggest, a serving spoon, dangled from the exhaust hood of the stove. All kids had their own self-comforting mechanisms. John knew from long experience that for most it was a thumb socked securely in the mouth. Abra's was a little different. She cupped her right hand over the lower half of her face and rubbed her lips with her palm. As a result, her words were muffled. John took the hand away gently.
"What, honey?"
In a small voice, she said,
"Am I in trouble? I...
Her small chest began to hitch. She tried to put her comfort hand back, but John held it.
"I wanted to be like Minstrosio."
She began to weep. John let her hand go, and it went to her mouth, rubbing furiously.
David picked her up and kissed her cheek. Lucy put her arms around them both and kissed the top of her daughter's head.
"No, honey, no. No trouble. You're fine."
Abra buried her face against her mother's neck. As she did it, the spoons fell. The clatter made them all jump.
13. 2 months later, with summer just beginning in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, David and Lucy Stone sat in John Dalton's office, where the walls were papered with smiling photographs of the children he had treated over the years, many now old enough to have kids of their own. John said,
"I hired a computer-savvy nephew of mine, at my own expense, and don't worry about it, he works cheap.
to see if there were any other documented cases like your daughter's and to research them if there were. He restricted his search to the last 30 years and found over 900.
David whistled. That many?
John shook his head. Not that many. If it were a disease, and we don't need to revisit that discussion because it's not, it would be as rare as elephantiasis, or Blaschko's lines, which basically turns those who have it into human zebras. Blaschko's affects about 1 in every 7 million. This thing of Abra's would be on that order.
What exactly is Abra's thing?
Lucy had taken her husband's hand and was holding it tightly.
Telepathy? Telekinesis? Some other tele?
Those things clearly play a part. Is she telepathic? Since she knows when people are coming to visit and knew Mrs. Judkins had been hurt, the answer seems to be yes. Is she telekinetic? Based on what we saw in your kitchen on the day of her birthday party, the answer is a hard yes. Is she psychic? A precognit, if you want to fancy it up. We can't be so sure of that, although the 9/11 thing and the story of the $20 bill behind the dresser are both suggestive. But what about the night your television showed The Simpsons on all the channels? What do you call that? Or what about the Phantom Beatles tune? It would be telekinesis if the notes came from the piano, but you say they didn't.
So what's next? Lucy asked. What do we watch out for?
I don't know. There's no predictive path to follow. The trouble with the field of psychic phenomena is that it isn't a field at all. There's too much charlatanry and too many people who are just off their damn rockers.
So you can't tell us what to do, Lucy said. That's the long and short of it. John smiled.
I can tell you exactly what to do. Keep on loving her. If my nephew is right, you have to remember that A, he's only 17, and B, he's basing his conclusions on unstable data. You're apt to keep seeing weird stuff until she's a teenager. Some of it may be gaudy, weird stuff. Around 13 or 14, it'll plateau and then start to subside. By the time she's in her 20s, the various phenomena she's generating will probably be negligible. He smiled. But she'll be a terrific poker player all her life.
What if she starts seeing dead people like the little boy in that movie? Lucy asked. What do we do then?
Then I guess you'd have proof of life after death. In the meantime, don't buy trouble. And keep your mouth shut, right?
Oh, you bet, Lucy said. She managed a smile, but given the fact she'd nibbled most of her lipstick off, it didn't look very confident. The last thing we want is our daughter on the cover of Inside View.
Thank God none of the other parents saw that thing with the spoons, David said.
Here's a question, John said. Do you think she knows how special she is?
The Stones exchanged a look. I don't think so, Lucy said at last. Although, after the spoons, we made sort of a big deal about it.
A big deal in your mind, John said. Probably not hers. She cried a little, then went back out with a smile on her face. There was no shouting, scolding, spanking, or shaming. My advice is to let it ride for the time being. When she gets a little older, you can caution her about not doing any of her special tricks at school. Treat her as normal, because mostly she is, right?
Right, David said. And it's not like she's got spots or swellings or a third eye. Oh, yes, she does, Lucy said. She was thinking of the call. She does so have a third eye. You can't see it, but it's there.
John stood up. I'll get all my nephew's printouts and send them to you if you'd like that.
I would, David said, very much. I think dear old Momo would, too.
He wrinkled his nose a bit at this. Lucy saw it and frowned.
In the meantime, enjoy your daughter, John told them. From everything I've seen, she's a very enjoyable child. You're going to get through this.
For a while, it seemed he was right.
Chapter 4. Paging Dr. Sleep.
1. It was January of 2007. In the turret room of Rivington House, Dan's space heater was running full blast, but the room was still cold. A nor'easter, driven by a 50-mile-an-hour gale, had blown down from the mountains, piling 5 inches of snow an hour on the sleeping town of Fraser. When the storm finally eased the following afternoon, some of the drifts against the north and east sides of the buildings on Cranmore Avenue would be 12 feet deep. Dan wasn't bothered by the cold. Nestled beneath 2 down comforters, he was warm as tea and toast. Yet the wind had found its way inside his head, just as it found its way under the sashes and door sills of the old Victorian he now called home. In his dream, he could hear it moaning around the hotel where he had spent one winter as a little boy. In his dream, he was that little boy. He's on the 2nd floor of the Overlook. Mommy is sleeping, and Daddy's in the basement, looking at old papers. He's doing research. The research is for the book he's going to write. Danny isn't supposed to be up here, and he's not supposed to have the pass key that's clutched in one hand, but he hasn't been able to stay away. Right now, he's staring at a fire hose that's bolted to the wall. It's folded over and over on itself, and it looks like a snake with a brass head. A sleeping snake. Of course it's not a snake. That's canvas he's looking at, not scales. Well, it sure does look like a snake. Sometimes it is a snake. Go on! He whispers to it in the stream. He's trembling with terror, but something drives him on. And why? Because he's doing his own research. That's why. Go on. Bite me. You can't, can you? Because you're just a stupid hose. The nozzle of the stupid hose stirs, and all at once, instead of looking at it sideways, Danny is looking into its bore. Or maybe into its mouth. A single clear drop appears below the black hole, elongating. In it, he can see his own wide eyes reflected back at him. A drop of water? Or a drop of poison? Is it a snake? Or a hose? Who can say, my dear Red Rum? Red Rum, my dear. Who can say? It buzzes at him, and terror jumps up his throat from his rapidly beating heart. Rattlesnakes buzz like that. Now the nozzle of the hose snake rolls away from the stack of canvas it's lying on and drops to the carpet with a dull thud. It buzzes again, and he knows he should step back before it can rush forward and bite him. But he's frozen, he can't move, and it's buzzing. "Wake up, Danny!" Tony calls from somewhere. Wake up! Wake up! But he can wake up no more than he can move. This is the Overlook. They are snowed in, and things are different now. Hoses become snakes. Dead women open their eyes. And his father? Oh, dear God, we have to get out of here. Because my father is going crazy. The rattlesnake buzzes. It buzzes. It.
2. Dan heard the wind howling, but not outside the Overlook. No, outside the turret of Rivington House. He heard snow rattle against the north-facing window. It sounded like sand. And he heard the intercom giving off its low buzz. He threw back the comforters and swung his legs out, wincing as his warm toes met the cold floor. He crossed the room, almost prancing on the balls of his feet. He turned on the desk lamp and blew out his breath. No visible vapor, but even with the space heater's element coils glowing a dull red, the room temperature tonight had to be in the mid-40s. Buzz. He pushed talk on the intercom and said, "I'm here. Who's there?"
"Claudette," I think you've got one, Doc.
Mrs. Winnick? He was pretty sure it was her, and that would mean putting on his parka, because Vera Winnick was in Rivington, too, and the walkway between here and there would be colder than a witch's belt buckle, or a well-digger's tit, or whatever the saying was. Vera had been hanging by a thread for a week now, comatose in and out of Shane Stokes' respiration, and this was exactly the sort of night the frail ones picked to go out on, usually at 4 a.m. He checked his watch. Only 3:20, but that was close enough for government work. Claudette Albertson surprised him.
No, it's Mr. Hayes, right down here on the first floor with us.
Are you sure? Dan had played a game of checkers with Charlie Hayes just that afternoon, and for a man with acute myelogenous leukemia, he'd seemed as lively as a cricket.
Nope, but Azzy's in there, and you know what you say.
What he said was Azzy was never wrong, and he had almost 6 years' worth of experience on which to base that conclusion. Azriel wandered freely around the three buildings that made up the Rivington complex, spending most of his afternoons curled up on a sofa in the rec room, although it wasn't unusual to see him draped across one of the card tables, with or without a half-completed jigsaw puzzle on it, like a carelessly thrown stole. All the residents seemed to like him. If there had been complaints about the house cat, they hadn't reached Dan's ears, and Azzy liked them all right back. Sometimes he would jump up in some half-dead oldster's lap, but lightly, never seeming to hurt, which was remarkable given his size. Azzy was a 12-pounder. Other than during his afternoon naps, Az rarely stayed in one location for long. He always had places to go, people to see, things to do. "That cat's a player," Claudette had once told Danny. You might see him visiting the spa, licking a paw and taking a little heat, relaxing on a stopped treadmill in the health suite, sitting atop an abandoned gurney and staring into thin air at those things only cats can see. Sometimes he stalked the back lawn with his ears flattened against his skull, the very picture of feline predation. But if he caught birds and chipmunks, he took them into one of the neighboring yards or across to the town common and dismembered them there. The rec room was open round the clock, but as he rarely visited there once the TV was off and the residents were gone. When evening gave way to night and the pulse of Rivington House slowed, as he became restless, patrolling the corridors like a sentry on the edge of enemy territory. Once the lights dimmed, you might not even see him unless you were looking right at him. His unremarkable mouse-colored fur blended in with the shadows. He never went into the guest rooms unless one of the guests was dying. Then he would either slip in if the door was unlatched or sit outside with his tail curled around his haunches, wayowing in a low, polite voice to be admitted. When he was, he would jump up on the guest's bed. They were always guests at Rivington House, never patients, and settle there, purring. If the person so chosen happened to be awake, he or she might stroke the cat. To Dan's knowledge, no one had ever demanded that Azzy be evicted. They seemed to know he was there as a friend. "Who's the doctor on call?" Dan asked. "You," Claudette promptly came back. "You know what I mean, the real doctor."
"Emerson. But when I phoned his service, the woman told me not to be silly. Everything's socked in, from Berlin to Manchester. She said that except for the ones on the turnpikes, even the plows are waiting for daylight."
"All right," Dan said. "I'm on my way."
3. After working at the hospice for a while, Dan had come to realize there was a class system even for the dying. The guest accommodations in the main house were bigger and more expensive than those in Rivington 1 and 2. In the Victorian manse, where Helen Rivington had once hung her hat and written her romances, the rooms were called suites and named after famous New Hampshire residents. Charlie Hayes was in Alan Shepherd. To get there, Dan had to pass the snack alcove at the foot of the stairs where there were vending machines and a few hard plastic chairs. Fred Carling was plopped down in one of these, munching peanut butter crackers and reading an old issue of Popular Mechanics. Carling was one of three orderlies on the midnight to eight shift,
The other two rotated to days twice a month. Carling never did. A self-proclaimed night owl, he was a beefy time server whose arms, sleeved out in a tangle of tats, suggested a biker past.
"Well, look at here," he said. "It's Danny Boy. Are you in your secret identity tonight?"
Dan was still only half awake and in no mood for joshing. "What do you know about Mr. Hayes?"
"Nothing except the cat's in there, and that usually means they're going to go tits up."
"No bleeding?" The big man shrugged.
"Well, yeah, he had a little noser. I put the bloody towels in a plague bag just like I'm supposed to. They're in Laundry A if you want to check."
Dan thought of asking how a nosebleed that took more than one towel to clean up could be characterized as little, and decided to let it go. Carling was an unfeeling dolt, and how he'd gotten a job here, even on the night shift when most of the guests were either asleep or trying to be quiet so they wouldn't disturb anyone else, was beyond Dan. He suspected somebody might have pulled a wire or two. It was how the world worked. Hadn't his own father pulled a wire to get his final job as caretaker at the Overlook Hotel? Maybe that wasn't proof positive that who you knew was a lousy way to get a job, but it certainly seemed suggestive.
"Enjoy your evening, Dr. Sleep," Carling called after him, making no effort to keep his voice down.
At the nurse's station, Claudette was charting meds while Janice Barker watched a small TV with the sound turned down low. The current program was one of those endless ads for colon cleanser, but Jan was watching with her eyes wide and her mouth hung ajar. She started when Dan tapped his fingernails on the counter and he realized she hadn't been fascinated but half asleep. "Can either of you tell me anything substantive about Charlie? Carling knows from nothing." Claudette glanced down the hall to make sure Fred Carling wasn't in view, then lowered her voice anyway.
"That man's as useless as boobs on a bull. I keep hoping he'll get fired."
Dan kept his similar opinion to himself. Constant sobriety, he had discovered, did wonders for one's powers of discretion.
"I checked him 15 minutes ago," Jan said. "We check them a lot when Mr. Pussycat comes to visit."
"How long's has he been in there?"
"He was meowing outside the door when we came on duty at midnight," Claudette said. "So I opened it for him. He jumped right up on a bed. You know how he does. I almost called you then, but Charlie was awake and responsive. When I said hi, he hied me right back and started petting Azzy. So I decided to wait. About an hour later, he had a nosebleed. Fred cleaned him up. I had to tell him to put the towels in a plague bag."
Plague bags were what the staff called the dissolvable plastic sacks in which clothing, linen, and towels contaminated with bodily fluids or tissue were stored. It was a state regulation that was supposed to minimize the spread of blood-borne pathogens.
"When I checked him 40 or 50 minutes ago," Jan said, "he was asleep. I gave him a shake. He opened his eyes and they were all bloodshot."
"That's when I called Emerson," Claudette said. "And after I got the big no way Jose from the girl on service, I called you. Are you going down now?"
"Yes."
"Good luck," Jan said. "Ring if you need something."
"I will."
"Why are you watching an infomercial for colon cleanser, Janny? Or is that too personal?" She yawned.
"At this hour, the only other thing on is an infomercial for the Abra. I already have one of those."
4. The door of the Alan Shepard suite was standing half open, but Dan knocked anyway. When there was no response, he pushed it all the way open. Someone, probably one of the nurses, it almost certainly hadn't been Fred Carling, had cranked up the bed a little. The sheet was pulled to Charlie Hayes' chest. He was 91, painfully thin, and so pale he hardly seemed to be there at all. Dan had to stand still for 30 seconds before he could be absolutely sure the old man's pajama top was going up and down. As he was curled beside the scant bulge of one hip. When Dan came in, the cat surveyed him with those inscrutable eyes.
"Mr. Hayes? Charlie?"
Charlie's eyes didn't open. The lids were bluish. The skin beneath them was darker, a purple-black.
When Dan got to the side of the bed, he saw more color. A little crust of blood beneath each nostril and in one corner of the folded mouth. Dan went into the bathroom, took a face cloth, wetted it in warm water, wrung it out. When he returned to Charlie's bedside, as he got to his feet and delicately stepped to the other side of the sleeping man, leaving Dan a place to sit down, the sheet was still warm from Azzy's body. Gently, Dan wiped the blood from beneath Charlie's nose. As he was doing the mouth, Charlie opened his eyes.
"Dan, it's you, isn't it? My eyes are a little blurry."
Bloody was what they were. "How are you feeling, Charlie? Any pain? If you're in pain, I can get Claudette to bring you a pill."
"No pain,"
Charlie said. His eyes shifted to Azzy, then went back to Dan.
"I know why he's here, and I know why you're here."
"I'm here because the wind woke me up. Azzy was probably just looking for some company. Cats are nocturnal, you know." Dan pushed up the sleeve of Charlie's pajama top to take a pulse and saw four purple bruises lined up on the old man's stick of a forearm. Late-stage leukemia patients bruised if you even breathed on them, but these were finger bruises, and Dan knew perfectly well where they had come from. He had more control over his temper now that he was sober, but it was still there, just like the occasional strong urge to take a drink. "Carling, you bastard. Wouldn't he move quick enough for you? Or were you just mad to have to be cleaning up a nosebleed when all you wanted to do was read magazines and eat those fucking yellow crackers?" He tried not to show what he was feeling, but as he seemed to sense it, he gave a small, troubled meow. Under other circumstances, Dan might have asked questions, but now he had more pressing matters to deal with. As he was right again, he only had to touch the old man to know.
"I'm pretty scared," Charlie said. His voice was little more than a whisper.
The low, steady moan of the wind outside was louder.
"I didn't think I would be, but I am."
"There's nothing to be scared of." Instead of taking Charlie's pulse, there was really no point. He took one of the old man's hands in his. He saw Charlie's twin sons at four on swings. He saw Charlie's wife pulling down a shade in the bedroom, wearing nothing but the slip of Belgian lace he'd bought her for their first anniversary. Saw how her ponytail swung over one shoulder when she turned to look at him, her face lit in a smile that was all yes. He saw a farmall tractor with a striped umbrella raised over the seat. He smelled bacon and heard Frank Sinatra singing "Come Fly With Me" from a cracked Motorola radio sitting on a work table littered with tools. He saw a hubcap full of rain reflecting a red barn. He tasted blueberries and gutted a deer and fished in some distant lake whose surface was dappled by steady autumn rain. He was 60, dancing with his wife in the American Legion Hall. He was 30, splitting wood. He was 5, wearing shorts and pulling a red wagon. Then the pictures blurred together the way cards do when they're shuffled in the hands of an expert, and the wind was blowing big snow down from the mountains, and in here was the silence and Azzy's solemn watching eyes. At times like this, Dan knew what he was for. At times like this, he regretted none of the pain and sorrow and anger and horror, because they had brought him here to this room while the wind whooped outside. Charlie Hayes had come to the border.
"I'm not scared of hell. I lived a decent life, and I don't think there is such a place anyway. I'm scared. There's nothing."
He struggled for breath. A pearl of blood was swelling in the corner of his right eye.
"There was nothing before. We all know that. So doesn't it stand to reason that there's nothing after?"
But there is. Dan wiped Charlie's face with the damp cloth. We never really end, Charlie. I don't know how that can be, or what it means. I only know that it is.
Can you help me get over? They say you can help people.